is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.
Hello and welcome to the Heat Check. My name is Wes Goldberg. Joining me from his bathtub full of red wine, it's David Ramil. How you doing, buddy?
Oh, I'm doing great, man. The fact that I have the kind of money to just sit there in red wine with a straw dangling out of my mouth, of course, because I don't want that shit to go to waste. I think it's perfect.
So, well, what kind of wine is it? Tell me that first. I mean, I get the important stuff.
It's the Way of Wade wine, of course.
I mean, of course it is.
It's what kind of question is that? It's the Heat Check podcast.
So, we're just bathing in these two wins that the Heat have in two nights right now.
Nicely done.
A lot of stuff looks good. We're going to get to a lot of things right now. Some interesting Hassan Whiteside rumors. ESPN's sure. reporting that the Lakers are going to target him. Maybe he's going to walk in free agency if he doesn't get the money. That's another report that's out there. We got a Twitter mailbag later on in the show. We're going to give you what you want. David and I are going to just break down some good old hypothetical trades and talk about some trade rumors and some names out there. But a couple of quick things on the docket really quick. Stories about that minority owner saying that LeBron James wanted to get Eric Spoelstra fired. This in the wake of Blatt getting fired in Cleveland. A lot of people think that LeBron had a lot to do with that. And then Ray Allen apparently has a standing offer to return. So let's just start with the first thing, Dave. This minority owner, and it's been shot down by a variety of reporters and personalities in South Florida, but that was kind of a weird thing to happen, right? To kind of loop the Heat back into this.
Yeah, he's a very, 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 very minority owner. So he's really not involved in the day-to-day ongoings of the team. He's not connected to the front office. He doesn't know really what he's talking about. But he was on an Israeli radio station where LeBron James has become public enemy number one because he fired the Israeli hometown hero, David Blatt. So, or that he was linked to that firing one way or the other. Obviously, it's overstated. It's a little irrational, ridiculous, but then again, the nation of Israel has never really been known for their rationality. So let's not go there anyway. I think all of it is overstated. It's not that big a deal. But yeah, you're right that it is a little odd that he loops back to Miami in that sense. And I think it just voices of what a lot of people have probably already assumed, that he didn't get along with Eric Spoelstra all too well, that maybe he just kind of dealt with them in a very business-like manner, and that maybe there wasn't a very good personal relationship there.
Yeah, you texted me something interesting, though, was that when all this Blatt stuff went down, that this really reflects a lot on Eric Spoelstra for being able to at least keep that thing together to the tune of four title runs and two championships with LeBron. It really speaks a lot of how Spoelstra was able to like wrangle in these stars' personalities.
Right. Yeah. I mean, whether you look at his X's and O's management or any of the other day to day things that a coach does, the fact that he was able to massage these huge personalities and get a guy like Chris Bosh to kind of change his game so completely. And you see that now with Bosh, and that he's much more flexible, much more interested in lots of things off the court. And he's a very flexible, open minded guy. But just the ability to manage all those personalities and have like these veterans like Ray Allen and Shane Battier and others kind of fit the mold and work alongside the team there. And, you know, winning does cure everything. So as long as the team was successful, you were probably going to see a lot better, you know, meshing of personalities. But that hasn't been the case in Cleveland, where there seems to be some friction both behind the scenes and obvious to everybody else around the organization as well. So Spoelstra's done an admirable job. You and I have talked about it a number of times. Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's got to rank pretty high up there in the NBA coaches' rankings in general about, you know, managing star personalities. And everybody, and, you know, a lot of former head coaches, Jeff Van Gundy is pretty vocal about it, will say things like managing a star player is one of the hardest things you can do as a head coach in the NBA. And
he said Spoelstra will be in the Hall of Fame someday, so that's a pretty big vote of confidence.
Well, I think that if Spoelstra just kind of continues on, even if Spoelstra's prime is behind him, you know, so to speak, with four straight title runs, that's a hard person not to vote into the Hall of Fame with his resume already, and his win percentage and everything like that. But it is interesting, and it also kind of says a lot about, you know, there was a lot of things about LeBron maybe not getting along with Spoelstra, as you said, but it never really came to the forefront. Like, it just kind of always was in Cleveland, you know? Like, after their first 20 games, it seemed like, you know, when LeBron went back to Ohio and Blatt was hired there, after the first, like, 20 games, it seemed like it was, like, he was done with Blatt and just kind of was just over it. And it kind of was always in the front of everybody's mind, where in Miami it just kind of seemed... And maybe Spoelstra doesn't deserve all the credit for that, because, you know, the Heat in general are a much stronger, tight-knit organization than Cleveland has ever been. But Spo definitely deserves a lot of credit for that. I don't think there's any doubt.
I think it's just so bizarre also that from all the different reports from, you know, the initial report from Adrian Wojnarowski, that it indicates just how much LeBron is invested in having the organization run his way, that he certainly wants much more of a stake as to how the organization is run, even having potential coaching candidates sign with his friend Rich Paul and agent Rich Paul. I'm sorry, yeah, Mark Jackson, exactly. I mean, that's bizarre. And trying to get Tyronn Lue to do it, and Tyronn Lue didn't. And you know, the Cavaliers, to their credit, said, look, we're not going to hire Mark Jackson whether he's with Rich Paul or not. So you can forget about him as a coaching candidate. And that kind of forced, I imagine, LeBron's hand a little bit to say, well, let's ride out and see how far David Blatt can take us. They went to the finals. They were successful. But it was clear that they didn't get along with him. The personalities just didn't mesh well. And it's just, you know, again, the Heat organization is run in a particular way, whether it's archaic or not. Whether, as some people have written, players deserve more power or more responsibility for how organizations are run, that's a whole other largely debatable question. But, yeah, clearly.
It seems like LeBron just keeps getting coaches fired, right? Or he never. I read a lot, obviously, about this whole David Blatt situation. And I can't remember who reported it, but somewhere it was reported that LeBron always felt like he needed a former player to coach him, right? That was the only way he was going to respect somebody. And,
yeah, I think I saw that.
And, I mean, if you think about the guys that he didn't get along with, Mike Brown, right?
Former player, though.
That's true.
Who before that? Paul Silas? Wasn't that his coach in Cleveland for a bit?
That's right. Paul Silas was fighting here, right?
Former player, yeah, former player.
So never mind. But Blatt, and Blatt's not a former player. Spoelstra is a former player, but not really, right? Like, he played in...
University of Portland, come on.
Yeah, but, you know...
Philippines' greatest player, right? I mean, I don't know.
The thing, what I'm getting at, though, is that LeBron doesn't really seem to have a great relationship with any coach. It doesn't seem like. Now, like, Ty Lue, he has apparently a good relationship, but Ty Lue's never been in charge.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see how long this lasts, you know.
He seems like a goofball. Am I wrong? Like, in all the post-game press conferences, he just seems like in over his head. Is he the mouthpiece of the team that has to do the post-game thing? Like, LeBron's really coaching that team, right?
I mean, if you read the reports that what LeBron was upset about, or that some of the other players on the team were upset that Blatt never called out LeBron, and you can understand why he wouldn't. Like, the guy wants some job security. He was hired to coach Kyrie Irving, Tristan Thompson, and Dion Waiters, not LeBron James and Kevin Love and championship expectations. That was never part of the plan when they first brought Blatt on board. Then LeBron goes over there. They changed the consistency of the team. And, I mean, oh, sorry, I forgot Andrew Wiggins as well. So he could have mentored a guy like Wiggins, given him that kind of international experience, help him grow and reach that next level of his game, which he may or may not achieve in Minnesota. But let's say Blatt might have been a little bit more capable of doing so than either Flip Saunders or, you know, certainly Sam Mitchell, who struggled as a head coach for the Timberwolves. So it's just so hard to say whether or not Blatt was the right guy for that team. And clearly LeBron didn't think so. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what to say about it that hasn't been reported
Yeah,
already.
it's been kind of talked about and reported. We can move on, but in general, we just give some props to Spo. This definitely, like you said, reflects well on him for at least being able to keep that thing together in a healthy way for 4 years. But would you bring Ray Allen back? I mean, this is something that kind of was reported and then kind of, you know, it was kind of a flash report. We kind of saw it, talked about it for a little bit and didn't, but we didn't get a chance to talk about it on the podcast, that the Heat apparently have a standing offer to Ray Allen. Now, what does that standing offer mean? I don't know. Was it just something where he walked out the door and kind of was always like, I don't know if I'm retired yet, I gotta wait for the right spot to open up, and just never really signed anywhere? Was it just a phone call saying, hey, just, you know, whenever you want to come back, we'll open up a roster spot for you? Or is it, it's hard to say, but it's just kind of interesting.
You know, we've heard reports or rumblings that maybe there was some friction between him and Spoelstra also.
About minutes and rotation stuff, which I'm sure LeBron wasn't happy about. You know, if LeBron didn't completely buy into Spoelstra's thing.
Right.
I mean, that's an interesting concept right there, is, you know, there was this whole facade, and obviously results were favorable, but what we all thought that the Heat were like this close-knit family. Even that last year, you know, there was rumblings about that locker room kind of being stressed, but that was usually just attributed to just the mass amount of pressure that they had, and three straight title runs going on four. But was there more of that like rotation stuff and just like little locker room dramas that were kind of just maybe eating that team up, and it was just a matter of time before it imploded?
Hard to say, right? Yeah. Without being there, but
sure.
You know, there's two things. One, I think most Heat fans would say that undoubtedly they'd love another chance at having Ray Allen on the roster. Mm. I mean, he's a respected veteran, you know, a Hall of Famer, according to ESPN, the 50th best player in NBA history. So that's something to consider. A hell of a shooter, still keeps in great shape, familiar with the organization, the players, the coaching, the front office. So he'd fit in perfectly, seamlessly. Even if he does have some issues with rotation or anything else, let's just say if he's open to coming back, he would definitely be a great fit, even if he can just, you know, work himself back into shape. And I think he'd probably be a factor right away or pretty soon after signing with Miami.
I agree.
But having said that, there is also a little bit kind of, it reeks, like I mentioned earlier to you offline, it reeks of desperation a little bit, right?
Yeah.
It's not a good look for Miami.
It's not a good look that it was reported, right? But it's also like, is it anything that we don't really know? Like, let's just say hypothetically Ray Allen called and said, I want to come back. Would they have been like, nah, we're good? Like, of course they would have signed him. I don't know. It's,
yeah, I mean, there's probably 29 other teams that would want Ray Allen there.
Sure. Yeah. I don't know. It was interesting. I don't think it's going to happen. I think Ray Allen's, he's not coming back to the NBA.
Oh, no.
He's going to come back to the league. It would have happened by now. But it was interesting that kind of surfaced. It also, you wonder if that report surfaced as a bat signal to Ray Allen. And if that's the case, then I agree with you that it's pretty desperate.
Well, I mean, you know, it comes as a result of a losing streak. You know, the timing is peculiar, and, you know, certainly not it's probably on purpose, but it's just, you know, their team's struggling. Their shooting is woeful. It becomes magnified during a losing streak. And all of a sudden it's like, hey, by the way, there has been a report that there's a longstanding offer to Ray Allen. It's just a little peculiar.
So let's talk about this 2-0 winning streak, because we get to call two wins in a row a winning streak now in Miami.
It is.
It is technically a streak. 2-0 on a related topic. Hassan Whiteside has not played in those two games. We'll get to Hassan Whiteside and his impact off the floor in a little bit. But 2-0, what looks good to you, Dave?
Not a whole heck of a lot. I mean, I think there are wins against a Brooklyn team that's not particularly good and a Chicago team that's fallen apart a little bit. So I guess you'd have to say that the defense has been pretty consistent with what it's been all year, despite the loss of Hassan Whiteside protecting the rim. So they've certainly shifted a lot more priority into guarding the perimeter. And if I had to put my finger on one thing that's been really good during those two games, it's the consistency of Wade scoring and the defense of Justice Winslow. Other than that, I can't say that anything has really stood out as far as like a positive trend for this team. And that's, you know, again, they're lacking their point guard, they're lacking their center, they're lacking some key players off the bench. So I'm not sure how much stock we can put into regular season games, just as we still can consider San Antonio a legitimate title contender, despite the fact that they got beat by 30 to, you know, the Golden State Warriors. I don't think you can put too much stock in a regular season game, or in this case, two regular season wins.
I'm going to have to disagree, because I thought that the ball movement was, well, I should say this, the player movement along with the ball movement was way better. I think the Heat have a tendency, and they've always had a tendency to kind of get stagnant when the ball moves. They kind of pass for no reason, and they call that ball movement. They'll just swing the ball back and forth, and nobody's cutting, nobody's setting screens. They just kind of stand around and play catch. But I've noticed a lot less of that in these last two games, which was good. And the fact that they were two wins as opposed to four losses is good, and the fact that it came in a back-to-back was very reassuring, and on the road. So I think that the most important thing here is that they broke the losing streak and that they are feeling good. I saw a quote today. Eric Spoelstra said it was this last game was one of the best third quarters he's coached all season, or that he's, you know, that he's seen all season from the Heat. And that's, if Spoelstra is calling it two good wins, even though it's against a broken Nets and a broken Bulls team, then, and I think coach speak, that means like he felt good about the way the team played, not that it was like a quote unquote quality win. But if Spoelstra's happy, I'm happy.
I don't know, man. I mean, I don't want to. Obviously,
the beginning of 27 game win streak. But shit, it's that's definitely not better happen than what we were doing last week.
Oh yeah, I mean, and you know, that just goes to show how far we've fallen. You know, and you can't. And we've seen this reaction before from Heat Twitter and Heat fans. You know, the losses become magnified, the wins become magnified. If there is more ball movement, you know, and positive passing leading to better shots, and if there's statistical evidence for it, I'm all for it. Maybe I didn't notice that myself, but I mean, you know, you've clearly got a keen eye for it, so I respect your opinion on that. But I just, you know, it's a Bulls team that kind of has been struggling, and it's the Nets. You know, the fact that Nets team.
People don't talk. Jim Butler made he was like 13 of 30 or something. 13 of
30 yeah.
Something.
Look, that was phenomenal. Again, Winslow's defense on him, especially at the end of that game, was ridiculous. Yes. I mean, for all the crap I worried about, you know, earlier this season, whether or not he might turn around and he might be a
productive. You're the only one that ever brings that up. I'm very careful not to bring up how you hated Justice Winslow and that you wanted to trade him.
I didn't say hate, Wes. I didn't say
you're already out on Winslow.
I did declare him a bust, I think, in week one. well, again, part of that was the fact that he was shooting woefully. He's gotten better. He's played better. He's played more, you know, because of the injuries to the roster. So clearly that growth has come hand in hand with more playing time, which is the way it should be. But yeah, his ability to stay with a guy like Butler, who's easily one of the best two-way players in the NBA, that was ridiculous. I mean, you got to love that about him and his active hands, his strength, his speed, everything else. I mean, well, very good stuff.
And Justice Winslow started those two games, right? Because Whiteside was out, so the Heat started Bosch, Winslow, and Dang in the front court. And speaking of Justice Winslow, in the last two games, you mentioned I was shooting better. In the last two games, were you going to say, sorry, what were you saying?
Sorry, no, Amar'e Stoudemire started. I think Winslow was still coming off the bench.
Oh, that's right, against the Bulls, right?
And against the
Nets?
Yes, sir. Stoudemire started.
So I guess, well, they played a lot of Winslow. Yeah, you're right. They played a lot of Winslow, Dang, and Bosch, though.
Because I remember Stoudemire coming off a curl screen under the rim for the first play of the game against Brooklyn, right, where he wound up going up for a dunk, and that was impressive.
Stoudemire's been playing really well.
I wrote about it,
you did. It was a good post for Harvard Proxism.
2 weeks ago, and now he's made me look like some kind of seer or something like that. I'm
well,
a genius.
Better than the opposite, right?
My Winslow projection, yeah. So, I mean, you win some, you lose some, I guess.
Yeah, just throw it all to the wall.
Exactly.
Well, speaking of Winslow, in the last two games, he's shot 9 of 11 for 21 points, has 16 rebounds, 6 assists, 4 steals, and just 2 turnovers.
Swiss Army knife.
9 of 11. What? I don't know. One of our mailbag questions is about him later. We'll get to his shooting, but in particular, his defense, top-notch. And I mentioned last time on the podcast, if we're talking, you know, while we're on the subject of us being right, I did say it's maybe time to start using Winslow at point guard. And I don't know if Eric Spoelstra listens to the heat check, but against the Bulls, Winslow brought the ball up for the first possession in the fourth quarter, and did so for a majority of the fourth quarter while he was in the game. And it looked really interesting. I mean, the problem with Winslow is that he really hurts the spacing, that he has been kind of just a spot-up shooter, you know, and not a good spot-up shooter because he hasn't been making a lot of his shots. And then when you put the ball in his hands, at least he can be a playmaker. At least he can pass. We know he's a good passer. You can get guys like get guys like Tyler Johnson off the ball, Dwayne Wade off the ball, so that Wade can get into the post early and Tyler Johnson can spot up because he's a good three-point shooter. I don't think this is viable necessarily when Goran Dragic returns or even when Beno Udrih is, you know, 100% healthy and in the game. But it's a good alternative for when you want to get Tyler Johnson off the ball, when Beno has to rest, when Dragic is hurt, and you don't want Wade to bring the ball up every play, just to facilitate some more ball movement, because we know Wade likes to just take over, and he's been great at it, but that's what he does. If you want to facilitate more ball movement, having Winslow setting up the offense and, you know, getting a pick and roll in the high post and the high screen and all that stuff, I think I liked it a lot. It was one of my favorite things from that game, and I think it's something I'd like to see going forward.
Okay, two things.
Yeah.
You said Beno. Is it Beno or is it Beno?
I'd say Beno.
Huh. I mean, I like it. It's hilarious when you say Beno, but I've always
thought... Well, I'm here, please.
Well, it's just... I think it's Beno, but you know what? Beno. Beno just sounds more funny. Is it Beno, that kind of pill that you take if you have gas or something like that?
Tums?
Isn't there like... There's some kind of like thing that you take, like, you know, I guess...
Pepto?
I think it's actually called Beno, man. Think it's there's a pill that you take. It settles your stomach.
I'm saying your name wrong.
Well, okay. And then secondly, even if he doesn't bring the ball up, that's Justice Winslow, who we assume does not need Beno or Beno. He looks like he's cutting a lot more too, right? I mean, he had a couple of shots where he was making like really good backdoor cuts and moving without the ball. Mm-hmm. There was one play in particular, I think, where he shed his defender and was wide open under the rim, and Wade was able to find him for an easy layup there. So, you know, the experience certainly seems like it's paying off, and it's shown up in the last few games. I mean, even before that, you mentioned two games he went 9 of 11, but the game before that he went 3 of 9, but he went 3 of 4 or 3 of 5 from 3-point range. So his shooting has, I'd say, certainly improved.
Yes, and I think he's putting. That's obviously where his disadvantage was coming into the season. So it's clear that the coaches were going to work with him on it, and maybe that's starting to come to fruition here on the court, is that maybe he's becoming a better shooter, but we'll get to more of that a little bit later on. Speaking of the last two games, Whiteside didn't play. To me, the ball movement looked better, and that game against the Nets was one of the better ball movement games that the Heat had all season. And speaking of Whiteside specifically, of Whiteside not being on the court, I pulled up some stats earlier today. Five of the seven games with the most assists came in January. So when we talk about the Heat and ball movement, it's clearly beginning better as the season went on. January's been a tough month in general, their ball movement has been good, right? So that's something to at least be positive about. Mm-hmm. The other two were in mid to late December. So basically the best, you know, the Heat have been playing their best as far as ball movement goes on, as the year goes on. And that's something to be expected with a new team, a very flipped-over roster, building chemistry and things like that. The interesting thing about that in regards to Whiteside is that he didn't play in two of Miami's top three games when it comes to assists. And that's not a huge sample size, but it's not nothing, right?
I mean, you've talked about it a number of times. You've broken down his game. His passing is historically bad. The ball goes to him, and he's not getting it out.
20 assists.
I'm sorry?
20 career assists.
Right. Didn't he have like two of them in his recent triple-double game, and that was like the most he's ever had in a game ever?
Yeah.
He's never had more than one assist in a game, and that's, you know, those are once every 20 games or so.
And just kind of going even further with his assisting stats, according to NBAWowie.com, when Whiteside's on the floor, the Heat average 21.3 assists per 100 possessions, right?
Okay.
Off the floor, 21.4 assists per 100 possessions. So 0.1 assists more when he's off the floor. But what I'll say about that is, if you think about the way Whiteside scores, a lot of his baskets are assisted.
Right.
Because usually by Wade, in the pick and roll. So
plus he plays, you know, like his the defensive numbers, the way people have, you know, explained him late, you know, he plays with the first and unit in the first and third quarter. Those are normally the teams with, you know, the lineups with Dragic out there, with Wade out there, the guys that are getting the most assists. So you assume that he's probably going to play with those high assist teams as opposed to with the second unit that probably isn't going to pass the ball as much or as efficiently.
And what I thought was interesting, so what I did was I looked at three-point attempts because none of Whiteside's, you know, Whiteside's not affecting the three-point attempts, at least directly, right? Because he's not getting assisted three-pointers on catch and shoot from three, right? So 6.3 assists on three-pointers per 100 possessions with Whiteside on the court. 6.8 with him off the court. That's a half-point margin in a, you know, per 100 possession sample size. That's pretty large, especially for the balance of the season if you kind of average it out. And, you know, and I think that even speaks volumes to, and even if it's not that big of a sample size, I think that speaks volumes because what Whiteside's supposed to be so great at is sucking in the defense, right? He gets the double teams, and he's consistently getting those double teams. And what you want out of that is for open three-point shooters. That's what they got with LeBron. That's what, you know, they get with Wade. That's what they get with Dragic. That's the whole idea of having somebody so dominant near the rim like Whiteside is, shooting better than 70%. I mean, Whiteside's at the rim numbers, I think, are like 78% right now. LeBron was at like 80%. So when we talk about just the gravity of a player or, you know, based on a raw percentage at the rim, he's right there with LeBron, you know? So, but none of that is being converted to three-pointers.
Do you have numbers for three-point attempts with him on off the floor?
Not right now, but I can find it.
Yeah, because I imagine they're probably higher when he's off, right? I mean, he doesn't. And that's, you know, again, that's not what he's supposed to be doing. He's supposed to be lending to more wide open shots, so you'd think that they'd take better shots. But the reality is probably not the case. They're probably shooting more with him off the floor because they move the ball around a little bit better. And you know, they still have guys that can attack the paint in Dragic and Wade and Bosch, and then that leads to open threes for, you know, whoever's out there with Whiteside out of the game.
I would imagine so. I'm trying to find the...
No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean for you to do that now, but I was just curious because I think it makes sense.
Let's do it right now. 430 attempts with him on the floor. Is that per game? No, that can't be per game. Total.
No, I think 430 attempts total with him on the floor over the past 40-something games.
I'm trying to find per minute. So that's in 1,100 minutes, almost 1,200 minutes, 430 attempts. Remember that number.
All right.
Okay. Off the floor. Let this load. Wow. How many minutes did I just say? 1,200?
1,200, yeah.
In about 200 fewer minutes, they have 459 three-point attempts.
Wow, that is huge.
What was the first number?
430 in 1,200 minutes.
So we're talking about it's 459, so we're talking about 30 more attempts in 200 fewer minutes.
In 1,000 minutes, yeah, they're shooting more. Wow. So, yeah. So, I mean, you remember when Shaq was first acquired, they had guys like Jason Capono and Damon Jones and stuff like that. It's like, yeah, you're surrounded with shooters, and that's when they're more effective.
That's three-point contest winning, Jason Capono, to you.
That's right. That's former Toronto Raptor great, Jason Capono. But yeah, you figured that's the difference. But, you know, he doesn't pass. And that was supposed to be the next evolution of Whiteside. He doesn't have a low post game at this point. He's very, very, very good at the pick and roll. His timing, his length is excellent. So, I mean, those things are elite and probably not going to ever change. But as far as his footwork is concerned, his low post game, it's pretty basic, not particularly effective, and his passing is non-existent, which is that's what Shaquille O'Neal was able to provide. You know, if he was double teamed or triple teamed, he'd find a wide open Jason Capone or Damon Jones or Gary Payton or one of the other shooters that was there during those 3 years of Shaq's greatness.
And even going away from Shaq, I mean, somebody, you know, arguably the best center in the game right now, DeMarcus Cousins, is a fantastic passer. Andre Drummond, he passes more than Whiteside. I mean, he doesn't pass a lot, but he passes more than Whiteside. That it's at least a threat, right? That's what you need. And a lot of these guys that, like you said, they get to the rim and they work so hard and they're so dominant in that pick and roll that that's supposed to open up some things. If the Heat ultimately want to be the team that they want to be, which is a, pace and space team where they shoot a lot more three-pointers and they're able to get open shots for their guys, especially with an aging roster with Bosch and Wade, guys that need more open shots, if you want Dang to be the spot-up shooter that we want him to be, then you're going to eventually Whiteside's going to have to pass, but it's just not going to work. So that's why I think a lot of recent talk, chatter, and now some rumors that we can get to are about moving on from Hassan Whiteside. But really quick before we even get to that, while Whiteside's here and when he gets back healthy, Ryan Youssefi from the Miami New Times wrote an interesting piece about a couple ways to fix the Heat. A couple things I really like in there, but most, and I urge Heat fans listening to at least go check that out. But one of the things I wanted to touch on, bringing Hassan Whiteside off the bench. Now, obviously, he's not going to like that. He's not with his attitude and not being the major key and the way he's built and he's got ice in those veins and whatever. But should we bring him off the bench? Because if you can play that great lineup of Bosch, Winslow, and Dang in your front court, bring Whiteside off the bench and have Whiteside going against, opposing bench units, that could be a really interesting advantage for the Heat to have, especially going down the stretch. If they're going to have to string along some wins, I think everything's got to be on the table right now.
Well, I think part of the rationale, if I remember the piece correctly, is that, he's likely gone from the team in the future. And so you play that to your advantage. Either you're going to trade him and you're not going to get much back in return because of his great contract value and the level of production that he does provide for Miami. So, you're probably going to keep him on the roster because you've got no other choice. So why not stash him on the bench, kind of force him to either, produce more in the 20 or so minutes that he does come off the bench, or it also drives his value down so that maybe you could match an offer to him in the offseason if you choose to re-sign him. So it's a win-win for Miami either way.
And as Youssefi pointed out, he doesn't play a ton of minutes right now. He's not playing over 30 minutes a game. So if you bring him off the bench, his minutes aren't going to change drastically. So if Whiteside's worried about his stats, that's not necessarily going to be impacted, and especially because he's going to be going against opposing bench teams,
right?
Then those stats should be inflated, if anything. So in 29 minutes, what he's averaging now, he could probably do what he does in 29 minutes against mostly starters in 20 minutes against bench players. So his stats wouldn't be impacted all that much. Obviously, there's that pride that goes along with being a starter, but holy crap, has Whiteside actually earned it, or is he just going to be that, like, that friend that we all have that just, like, is so annoying and complains about everything that you just kind of just give it to him just to make him shut up? Like, are we just going to, like, give him that starting spot even though it's not ultimately best for the team? And what I worry about is if you start getting into a situation where you cater to Eric Spoelstra, if Eric Spoelstra caters to Whiteside, right, just to make sure that volcano doesn't explode, then that doesn't really do justice to the rest of that roster and the rest of that locker room, because they're going to be like, well, we earn our spots. We don't just, moan and bitch in the locker room about not starting or not getting enough playing time or not getting enough touches or the team not running plays for us. And, you have guys like Tyler Johnson coming off the bench and Amari Stoudemire, a veteran, coming off the bench. But you're going to start Whiteside because he's just kind of a dramatic head case. Like, I don't know. I'm not saying that that's what's happening, but obviously it's idealistic, but It just it bothers
it's,
me.
It's hard to argue that he hasn't earned the right to start, though, right? I mean, we've discussed this many times, and the perception of fans differing from the perception of writers and the perception of the team. They are aware of the on-off court numbers and that maybe they're not in Whiteside's favor, but they still love the ability to, you know, drive to the hoop, to grab the rebound, to block shots.
Well, less about then earning the spot, but if it's best for the team for Whiteside to come off the bench just because of lineups and rotations, then that's what they should do, right?
That would take a monumental paradigm shift from a guy who's never displayed that ability before. Like, he's just... That would take Alonzo Mourning and Juwan Howard and Spoelstra and Riley saying, look, we're going to publicize this. We're going to announce that we want you off the bench, but it's not indicative of a lack of moral fiber or a lack of ability, but that it's just a difference in the way we're playing. Look, he's already bitched and kvetched about not playing in the fourth quarter. If he's already complaining about not playing the last 3 minutes of a game that's tightly contested, where he's probably not going to have a positive impact anyway because of his woeful free throw shooting, imagine what it's like when he's not going up against the very best big men in the league. When he's not going up against Brook Lopez, he's going up against, I don't even know, Andrea Bargnani? I mean,
yeah, who's
he going to guard in these second units and feel, I mean, wouldn't that make him, it would be a great test. And he should understand that if he wants to pass that test for the 29 other potential employers, he should accept whatever role the Heat give him and thrive in it if he really wants to show how much he's worth and that he deserves a ton of money. But I don't see Whiteside being that guy. Like, he just doesn't strike me as saying, oh yeah, I'm going to guard lesser known second and third tier centers as opposed to Brook Lopez or, Andre Drummond or DeMarcus Cousins, right, et cetera, et cetera.
And so that's the interesting thing, and that's what the Heat, when they brought on Ray Allen and stuff like that, they brought veterans who had been there. They've been starters. They've been great players. They've been all-stars, right? They've done what they needed to do. And then you bring them to come off the bench for that one more ring. Whiteside doesn't have that resume.
Good point.
So even so, it does make you wonder. So if Whiteside coming off the bench is not an option, are the Heat better off just trading him? So we might as well just get into these trade rumors. ESPN reports that the Lakers are going to target Hassan Whiteside at the deadline. And then Basketball Insiders is reporting, you know, minutes before we recorded this podcast that if the Heat don't give him a max deal, something around $20 million next year, that he's going to walk. Because somebody, and we have discussed this many times, somebody's going to offer him that money. So I guess, according to Basketball Insiders, and one leads to believe, and like I said, we've talked about this, he's probably not somebody that's going to leave $8 to $10 million just sitting on the table to be part of the Heat, right? There's 29 other teams. He, quite frankly, deserves to just go chase whatever money. Like, I'm never going to say, like, he shouldn't just go get as much money as he can, especially when he's coming from playing in Lebanon. He should cash in, but...
Sure. And that's something we should point out. You know, as we cover the league more closely, you know, we hear about this quite a bit internally from players and from front offices. They never begrudge anybody getting their money. And that's something that a lot of fans, for whatever reason, assume that players should always take less money, even though in their own private lives, they would never take less money. They would never go to a job and it's going to overwork them and underpay them. So it's a little irrational, but we should point out that we never hold it against somebody like Whiteside if he goes and chases $20 million from the Lakers or Charlotte or whoever offers it to him.
Yeah, I mean, if you're LeBron and make up this whole lie and facade that you want to go back to Cleveland because you want to go back home, then we'll give you some crap about it. But if he was just going for the money, it's no big deal. Anyway, so yeah, if that's the case, if the Lakers are going to target him, we assume that there's a market for him. And then if he's going to walk, if the Heat don't pay him, which I don't think that they're at a point where they're going to feel comfortable paying him $20 million, not with what he's shown this year so far, then it makes a lot of sense to trade him at the deadline. The one loophole in that, and I want to get to this really quickly before we talk about trading Whiteside, as we continue to put that off to the end of the podcast to make sure everybody keeps listening. Does this David Blatt situation affect what the Heat do at the deadline? Because if the Cavs were dominant and it just seemed that they had the East wrapped up, would it be easier to say, even if we take a step back for this next half season by trading Whiteside, we gain something in the future and we put ourselves in better position next year to make a run? I understand that logic. But now with maybe things being a little bit shakier in the Eastern Conference, do they say, let's just see what we can do with this roster? Whiteside, assuming they don't get a really great blockbuster offer for Whiteside, a big-name player for Whiteside, and we're just going to assume that for no other reason other than the conversation, but Whiteside represents the best chance for us to go as far into the playoffs as possible. Whiteside represents our ceiling right now this season. We got to hold on to him, regardless of if he walks or not, because we got to see what we can do in the playoffs. Do you think this Blatt situation affects the Heat's mindset?
I don't think so, because I think the Heat were always going to try and make a push this season regardless.
Yeah.
I just don't see them being – we've talked about it recently, and it's changed my perspective a lot, especially in context of how other teams run their respective organizations, that Miami's, I think, more content to go all in and wind up failing as they did last year than sacrifice even a few months of mediocrity. Like even in 08, 09, and you know, right before the Big Three era, they were still a playoff team. And maybe you can build most of that off of the fact that, you know, Wade was playing at an MVP type level. But I mean, they were still competing. They were still, you know, doing, you know, admirable work, and they were still trying to make the playoffs, even if they weren't legitimately going to contend for a title. But I don't think they're ever going to sacrifice this year and not necessarily tank, but not try for a postseason berth. I mean, they're going to go for it one way or the other, whether it's the eighth spot because they're going to try their best, or, you know, maybe the second or third spot in the East, they're going to try for it one way or the other and hope that maybe they can unseat the Cavs or whoever winds up being the best team in the Eastern Conference.
One thing I'll say to that is that the only time they'll ever take a step back, like a real step back, is when they're trying to avoid some luxury tax, right? We saw that with Joel Anthony, Mike Miller, yeah. Mario Chalmers.
Yeah, but, I mean, those, they didn't...
Well, the reason I bring that up is because if you can attach Chris Anderson's contract and even like Josh McRoberts' contract onto Whiteside, and you move him for somebody comparable, and then you can kind of say, like, look, we're going to move to small ball, we're going to move these two $10 million worth of basically dead money on the roster, then take maybe a little bit less money back and get maybe 80% of what Whiteside is in return, I think you can sell that.
Hmm.
I don't know. It's just a thought.
Yeah.
So you're almost using, you can use Whiteside as a tool to clear the books a little bit, especially if you're trying to make a run at a big name free agent this season. Let's just get to some Whiteside stuff, some trade rumors. With the Lakers, I proposed it in the last podcast, straight up for Jordan Clarkson. I still like that deal a lot. I don't know why, but I think it's clean, it's painless, it makes sense for both teams for what they need.
Yeah, my concern is still, you know, whether or not you're going to be able to use Tyler Johnson. He's going to cut into his minutes, and I'm not sure Clarkson represents a significant upgrade. I think you reasoned last time that he was or pretty comparable in skill set, but then why bother making a trade? I mean, I know you want to trade for something at this point if you think that Whiteside is not going to be part of the future, but to me, I'd almost rather hope that you can include him in a larger deal where you might be able to get something better, you know, something that's missing right now. And to me, that what's missing right now is shooting. So if you could find some way of prying an elite level 3-point shooter off a team, that's to me the more important goal.
See, I agree with that. I think if we know Riley, then he's going to look to, he's not going to make a deal that just brings a bunch of role players to the roster. I mean, he has, right? He did that, the biggest trade of all time, that was essentially for a bunch of role players, right?
But what deal is that?
That, like, that trade that he made to fill out the roster around Shaq and Wade, like the Antoine Walker trade.
Oh yeah, but I mean those were still even high level role players.
Exactly.
I mean, maybe so, guys in the past. Like, yeah.
He's not going to bring in like Brandon Wright. You know what I mean?
Right. Right. Now they're going to be included. Like, I mean, he'll he'll trade Goran Dragic then, you know, but he'll want somebody who's like a point forward or somebody who can bring the ball up or something. You know, he'll package Whiteside and Dragic and Luol Deng, but he'll acquire like a superstar as a result. Right. Something.
Or something.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and all of a sudden decide he doesn't want to just go big. He wants to go super big, you know.
Right. So, I mean, the Lakers don't have much of anybody super big to bring on. I mean, you could talk about Lou Williams. Roy Hibbert is literally super big, but I don't think that helps what the Heat want to do at all.
Not at all.
But
that would be ironic, though, wouldn't it?
If you brought in Roy Hibbert.
Yeah, and revitalizes his career somehow. I mean, he's still young, right? I mean, what is he, like 27 or something?
Well, we're two, three years removed from him basically changing the way centers play defense with quote-unquote verticality.
Right.
Which is a load of crap anyway, but whatever.
But he was the linchpin of arguably the best defensive team in the world until the Big Three destroyed them in the playoffs and everybody was like, oh, it's overrated anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And a team that almost that basically gave the Heat its biggest challenge for 2 years in the playoffs. It's been interesting this fall. It would be interesting if they traded like Luol Deng and Whiteside for, or if you could, technically you can do McRoberts, Chris Anderson, and Hassan Whiteside, and then you get rid of those contracts and you just bring in Roy Hibbert. But then you'd only have 13 players on the roster.
You know, it's crazy. It's less than $100,000 difference in the contracts of DeMarcus Cousins for Goran Dragic and Hassan Whiteside. According to the ESPN trade machine, I'm looking at it right now, it's 15.8 for DeMarcus, 15.76 for the combined Goran and Hassan Whiteside contracts.
Yeah, but
I'm pulling the trigger. That's it. We've got our big man of the future.
Sacramento's not. Don't push that button, Dave. Sacramento's not doing it. I think Sacramento's ready to keep Boogie. I think they're done. I don't think they trade him.
No, especially not when they have Rajon Rondo as their point guard either. So, I mean, that would have to be part of a much bigger, wider net of trades, and I don't think that's going to happen. I think they're legitimately thinking they can contend for a playoff spot in the West, and they've been playing much better, and DeMarcus Cousins is playing at an incredibly high level lately. So, maybe they might be what finally throws off the Golden State Warriors on their championship quest.
The Kings are that good.
The Kings are that good. The battle of the California teams there. And you're right there for it. I mean, you're a lucky man.
I am. I went to one Warriors game. It was a lot of fun, I got to say. But I haven't been to a Kings game yet. What is it called? The mattress sleeper? Sleep train arena?
Sleep train arena, yes.
Worst arena name ever. Come to our giant mattress and go to sleep while you watch the Kings.
No, I think the Utah Jazz one is the worst. I can't remember now exactly where they play.
The best one is the Smoothie King Center, New Orleans.
New Orleans, yeah.
Name your center office after Smoothie King. I'm on board.
Let's see. You know, I gotta find out what the name of this the Utah one is. I don't know what it's called. Like nobody calls it that or something like that. I don't know. It's like got a weird, weird name. I can't remember now. You know, speaking of which, I know we've talked about this before as far as other teams are concerned. I just saw from Awful Announcing, they released their rankings of the top or the 30 NBA announcement crews around the league as far as league pass and things are concerned. Guess where our very own Fox Sports South Florida, Eric Reed and Tony Fiorentino fall on the list?
Interesting. 11.
No, 25th.
What?
25th. Yeah, 25th.
What's their reasoning?
Just you know,
little crap.
I mean, it's peculiar because they said that, you know, they rank like the highest on a scale of A to F, you know, what the most number of votes from their readers were, and they got 25% A's. So I guess they just tallied it up, and they, you know, most people really, or a lot of people really love them, but most people are either completely benign towards them or just dislike them altogether. So. I mean, the number one team was the New York Knicks with Bream and Walt Clyde Frazier.
That makes sense. Who's number two? Just name off the top five.
Oh, I can't remember now.
I think in front of you.
No, I'm sorry. I looked at it earlier this afternoon, and I can't remember now. Oh, Charlotte, Milwaukee, I think. No, not Charlotte. Charlotte was like top 10. Milwaukee was number one. I think Portland was a top
Portland,
five.
I was going to say. Portland is still my favorite. I really like Portland.
Yeah, Mike Rice. He's great.
Was it Awful Announcing or Deadspin? What'd you say?
Awful Announcing.
Oh, that's from 2012.
Is it? No, I just found it this morning.
I found an old one, I think. It was just the top 15.
No, it's just interesting because I know we've talked about the different crews before, and the criteria is kind of difficult to really, you know, nail down there. And I mean, if you watch all, you know, some people just look. Oh, Dominique Wilkins was ranked one of the top. I think Dominique in Atlanta was ranked one of the top five ones. And I can't stand Neek. I mean, he is awful. He is. Really, it's like, you know, you love him, the player, but the announcer, very, very bad.
At
so.
Least they had the Cavs at 26. We're one spot over the Cavs. That's a little crap.
Austin Carr. I mean, Marble Mouth Austin Carr. That's so difficult to understand.
He is so awful. Why does he still have a job? Just because he's him?
I think so. Because Cleveland fans. Again, you watch and listen to these guys, and you probably are just so used to it. I mean, did you ever hear games with Dr. Jack Ramsey?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I wonder how he would have been perceived by, you know, other markets or other fans. Maybe they would have thought he was senile or a doting old man or something like that, even though he wound up, you know, covering games or broadcasting for ESPN Radio after he left Miami. But I thought he was great, you know, and you just – you never know. Like Tony Fiorentino, maybe he has a lot of insight, but he's also very corny. He's very hokey.
Yeah.
And, you know, every other game he talks about his mom. I mean, it's – there's a lot to dislike.
I like the personal touch. I like to get to know my color guys.
I'm voicing the concerns of the fans because I personally love them. I would never change them, but
I think just from a I watch a lot of the rival play-by-play guys because for some reason Comcast decides that I don't get the Heat broadcast crew for like half the games, and it's not even in HD either, so I don't even know why I pay $200 or whatever I pay for this crap, but. Either way, I end up listening, and I think that Eric Reed has got a good, like, maybe they don't say the best stuff. Like, Tony Fiorentino, nobody's going to say he's the most knowledgeable color guy, right? He kind of just is there to agree with Eric a lot of times or point out, like, a blown call by a ref or say something nice about the Heat players. That's really kind of his niche.
Right.
He's never going to teach you something, right? Like, well, he's not going to teach you and I something. He's not for the high-level fan. But Eric is really just good at... His voice is really great for broadcast. He's really good at enunciating and getting excited at the appropriate times. He captures the intensity of the game, I think, really, really well. And you know, you and I have talked about Jax many times in the past. We think he's fantastic. One of the best on-court guys in the league, I think. But I think that just in general between Fiorentino, Reed, and Jackson, they're just good at broadcasting, right? They're just good at just speaking and engaging.
I think so. I think Tony's kind of worked on it. You know, he was there during the Big Three era, and it kind of goes to show you that Miami, the front office, just said, you know what, we could hire a bigger name. We could try and grab somebody else, but we're going to stick with our guys. And that it's worked out. Because remember, even before that, they had Mike Fratello. Then he left. Mm-hmm. And they kind of said, you know what? We don't have anybody else. Let's put Tony Fiorentino in that position. And he worked. He worked really well. So, I mean, they've got good chemistry with him and Eric. So, you know, and it's funny you mentioned Eric Reed's voice because I happened to be there when the Heat were playing Orlando. And I was covering the game as well. And he's the same exact way in person. Like, his voice doesn't change. Like, he's sitting there in a quiet conference room, you know, during the press conference with Coach Scott Skiles, and he talks to them exactly the same way as you've heard him on TV for years. It's kind of weird and disarming. And Fiorentino's the same way, too. Like, so everybody...
The Magic, they're ranked at 16. That's a load of crap. This awful announcing poll is awful. Magic or 16th? Scott,
I don't mind them. I don't mind them. I think people... You don't like the Orlando broadcast crew?
No. Not at all.
I mean...
They're fine, but no. I just really don't like...
I'm glad
they only ranked the Warriors 14th. I don't like
the
Warriors.
The comments on the Golden State team, and I was curious about that. Like, they hate the play-by-play guy. The color guy, they think he's okay. But play-by-play, they're like, this guy is a worthless bag of you-know-what. I mean, he's just, they can't stand him.
I watch a lot of Warriors games, as you know, living out here, and because of the Warriors, and they're amazing to watch. I've muted it. That I've just muted it. And if it's on ESPN, I 100% watch the ESPN broadcast. If it's on TNT, same thing. But so Bob Fitzgerald is the play-by-play guy. Jim Barnett's the analyst. Jim Barnett is Tony Fiorentino. He's a throwaway guy to me. It's fine. I don't care. He just he's there to say nice things about the Warriors, and that's fine. A lot
but Fitzgerald,
of
no.
I've brought up this, by the way, to Warriors fans. I'm like, how, like in person, like, how do you stand your broadcast crew? And they're like, are you kidding me? Bob Fitzgerald and Jim Barnett? Bob Fitzgerald's the best. Barnett's a freaking legend, man. I'm like, okay, sorry, my bad. I think they're awful, but whatever.
Wow.
Fitzgerald, to me, comes off as a little pompous about the Warriors. Like, what I liked about Eric Reed was that, and you know, Tony too, Eric and Tony, they never, I don't know if they came off necessarily, maybe this is just me, like, fanboying over the 4 years of the Big Three. They never came off as we're better than everybody else just because we're calling this team, which is the best team in the NBA. But I think the Warriors are just so dominant that Bob Fitzgerald does this thing where he just will laugh after they score. And it's so irritating. It just seems so pompous. I'm like, dude, you don't do any, like, you have not gotten better or worse at your job. You are just with a really historically great team, you don't get to take part in their joy. You just play, you just call the game. He just comes off as a little pompous, like little frat boyish kind of like, and not to just completely disparage somebody, but that, you know, he's not gonna listen to this, but it's, I don't know. I don't know how else to explain it. Does that make sense? He just comes off as like, sure, he's taking credit for how good the Warriors are. And he will literally laugh after Steph Curry makes a three-pointer and not say a word. He'll just be like, ha, ha, ha. And then Barnett will be like, wow, what a great three-pointer. Great dribble with a step back. And nobody does that like Steph Curry does. And that'll be it.
That sounds annoying.
It's annoying as hell.
I'm kind of glad I don't watch the Warriors local broadcast as much. Oh, man, that sounds terrible.
Oh, my gosh. We could do a whole podcast just tearing apart these guys.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree 100%. I mean, we talked about this last year. We could have done one on just commercials alone from all the 29 other teams.
That's a project we got to get on.
That's an off-season job.
Really quick, like, off of just in or out on three-team broadcast crews for local broadcast crews. Like two analysts. Play-by-play and two analysts.
What do you mean? Like, pick two?
No, like, you know how, like, the standard is that you got a play-by-play guy and a color guy.
Right.
A lot of these teams will have a play-by-play, not a lot, but there's a handful of teams in the NBA that have a play-by-play guy and then two color people.
Right. Yeah, a three-man booth, like Houston and Charlotte do that too.
Yes, exactly. Houston, Charlotte, Dallas.
Right.
And then there's one other team that has like somebody that does like the Jackson guy, like the on-the-court reporter, the sideline reporter that just has like a live like feed into the broadcast and will just like chime in like a lot, so they're basically a third person. I can't remember who it is. I think it might be
Milwaukee
actually.
Oh no, I thought it was Milwaukee.
Or maybe it's Milwaukee, I don't know.
No, because I know Charlotte has like a three-man crew. They have Stephanie Reddy, or I think,
yeah,
or
that's who it is. And she's like, she'll do like on the court and she'll go as a color person too, I think, so she'll like bounce in between. And I thought, I didn't like it when she was on the court, and it doesn't matter, in or out on the three-team crew.
I mean, I've
three-person booth,
I'm out, because I think that I've yet to see it done really well.
Yeah, I'm out. Except on national TV. I know I just asked about local, but if Mark Jackson is calling the game, I need a third person in there.
Oh, right, yeah. I mean, the
like Jeff.
What do you think of the chemistry with
Jackson?
What do you think of the chemistry with Van Gundy? Is it bad, good?
What, between Van Gundy and Jackson?
Yeah.
I can't stand Mark Jackson. He is awful. Because it just seems like all the time he's just lobbying for a coaching job.
Well,
I mean, he is, but it's just like, it just seems like that, which I have a problem with. Like, don't make it so obvious.
I mean, he was lobbying for one, then he got the Golden State job, and now he's lobbying for one again. I mean,
like, what I would do is, no. That's just flat out wrong. It's like, it's one thing to lobby for, like, yourself, but he, like, puts down coaches a lot of times where Jeff Van Gundy doesn't. It's like, are you trying to get him fired so you can take his job? Like, this is awkward. Like, are you just, like, it seems like that a lot. And then he'll just, like, it'll be, like, three possessions later. Like, I can't believe he took that timeout when he did. And it's just like, Jackson, it's fine. Anyway, we need to move on.
I think so.
All right, Twitter mailbag, really quick.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, we haven't done that yet. So, thanks to everybody that tweeted at us, David and I, some Twitter questions. First one from Jeff Nicholas. Jeff Nicholas, JNico20 at Twitter. Thanks for reaching out, Jeff. Is Winslow's shooting form improving, or is this a small sample theater?
I think we talked about it, just a combination of more experience and a little more playing time. I haven't seen his particular shooting motion improve from where he started off in the season, although I imagine the team is working with him even when they get the occasional time for practice. Now that they're, you know, been on the road so much, they haven't had as much time to practice, so you imagine it's probably not working as much. But he's improved, so I think it's just a matter of him getting more comfortable and playing more.
I think improving is accurate, because like you said, I'm sure it's being worked on with the coaching staff. Fixed? No, obviously not quite. But I think this is, I don't think that we can count on these kind of numbers, or just that his shooting is going to be not horrible for us this season. I think he's going to be streaky,
mm-hmm.
which is better than what it was. Streaky's better. Right. That's improved. All right. From Jeff again, is Green's knee affecting his shooting, or is this just bad play? I guess because Green's struggling. So is his knee the issue here? I just think that we knew what Green was coming in. He was a streaky shooter. He'll win you a game, or he'll shoot you out of a game.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the injury probably doesn't help, sure. but it's probably a combination of both, too. You know, so he was going to have bad games regardless, some really, really terrible ones. It hasn't seemed to affect his explosiveness. He still gets up for the dunk every once in a while. So, I mean,
yeah.
it's just, you know, there are going to be games where he's not going to shoot particularly well, and the injury doesn't help.
Michael Sands, our friend and editor over at Sir Charles in Charge, what would a Whiteside to Lakers trade look like? Well, we talked about that, but I don't think it would be anything that is going to blow the doors open. I think it's something that revolves around, like, what would it look like? I guess Lou Williams, right? That's, like, the biggest name that he can get. Maybe, like, Brandon Bass gets thrown in there. But, like, maybe, like, a Lou Williams and Brandon Bass, which equals about $10 million for... Josh McRoberts, Chris Anderson, and Hassan Whiteside, and maybe the Lakers have to throw something else in there, but maybe not even. I don't even think they do. I think that's a pretty fair trade. Lou Williams and Brandon Bass for Whiteside and the two $5 million contracts, McRoberts and Chris Anderson. I think that's what it would look like.
They might make us take Hibbert, too.
Well, what do we have to give up Dang, right?
Yeah, they just want to get rid of Horry Hibbert, though.
Yes. Expiring contract, but I don't think Hibbert's going to be moved.
No, I can't see him.
Yeah, that's what I imagine it would look like.
I see that we have an extra couple of questions from Jeff. Did you get to those already, or did you choose not to ask those?
Jeff got two of his questions answered.
Well, it's a good one, Jeff.
Are they good? Do you want to answer them?
Well, one of them in particular. The other one you hinted at, as far as where Spoelstra ranks and as far as the active coaching list.
Sure.
I mean, that's a tough one. You know, obviously Popovich, I think, is first. You have to give some credit to Rick Carlisle,
yep.
Doc Rivers.
No, not Doc. Not over Spo.
Not over Spoelstra. Well, okay. Budenholzer.
I like Coach Bud, but I need to see a bigger body of work.
Dwayne Casey.
Same thing for Casey. He's been he was on the hot seat like 3 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, he's got Toronto playing really, really well, and they've had
He's a good coach. I definitely put him top 10 right now. I don't know. I have Steve Pop Kerr. And Carlisle and Spo as my top three.
Steve Kerr?
Oh, duh, Steve Kerr.
I mean, you kind of have to, right? I mean,
yeah. That's probably your four, right? Pop, Carlisle, Spo, and Kerr. That's probably your big four. Brad Stevens.
Yeah, sorry. I think he supplants Spoelstra as your top four. I think a lot of people around the league respect what he does a whole hell of a lot more than what Spoelstra.
I've heard a little bit of a backlash this year, though, with his rotations and stuff like that. That he doesn't seem to really understand how to use this roster. And it's a tough roster to use. He doesn't have a superstar on it, but...
No, he does not. Kelly Olynyk notwithstanding.
Pop, Carlisle, Spo, Coach Bud, Casey, Steve Kerr, Brad Stevens. Got to throw Jason Kidd in there.
No, you don't. No, you don't.
I think Jason Kidd is so underrated as a head coach. He had the Brooklyn Nets good.
I think he just liked the fact that he doesn't care and he's willing to do things differently. And I mean, you got to give some credit to that, I guess. But
I'm putting Kidd in there.
All right, go for it. I'll put Budenholzer. You put Kidd. We'll see who wins.
I like Budenholzer. Oh, Terry Stotts in Portland. He's been doing wonders with that Portland team. That
He's underrated. I think that's a little West Coast bias there, I guess, but
he's
he's
a very good
underrated.
coach. I think if you put him on a team, if once this team develops, he's going to be known as one of the better coaches in the league. I think he already is, but he's going to be more widely known. George Karl, I mean, he's been, it took a while, but he's got the Kings in the playoffs right now.
I saw some tweets about that maybe George Karl is simply just a master at passive aggressive manipulation.
That is fine. That is some Zen shit. That's like Phil Jackson stuff or something. Mind
I mean,
control? That can at least get you in the top 10.
it's kind of a short-term thing though. It's not a prolonged, sustainable way of coaching people.
He's
More
got a
it's
way of doing that, right? He just kind of will
right.
get people kicked into gear and then you fire him and bring in a new coach.
Well, I remember one of my first jobs years ago, and there was a woman who worked there who was like a veteran of like the industry and really just had seen every kind of working situation possible. She was like in her 50s or whatever, the 60s maybe, and she was just really, really smart. And she told me one thing about leaders and bosses. She said there are two kinds of bosses. One that will rally their company and their employees to work together as a group, or one that will be so hated that they'll force everybody to work together against them, you know, and then kind of like create like division in the ranks. And that seems to be what George Karl kind of thrives on. He's like, look, go ahead, hate me if you want to, just so long as you prove me wrong by playing better. And it's worked. It's worked. The team is playing well. They're like we said, they're contending for a playoff spot. And part of that is the genius of Rondo, as much as I hate saying that sentence out loud, and the incredible ability of DeMarcus Cousins, but they're taking this ragtag bunch of a roster and they're stringing together some real quality wins. So, I mean, you can't discount what Karl has done, and he's done it historically. He coached Milwaukee, he coached Denver, he coached Seattle years ago. I mean, he's been a quality coach for a good long time.
We forgot Stan Van Gundy.
We did, and I think it's okay. Like, I think we might.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I mean, we personally love Stan, but I don't know. There's something about him that I think just burns teams out.
Some George Carliness.
No, I don't think he gets people to hate him. I think he really does want to work together with people, but it's just he's so. I remember this being the concern with Shaq, right? That he was so emotional and so demonstrative that people are just like, look, dude, we're professionals. We don't need you dying because we threw a pass out of bounds, or because
Right.
we, you know, caused a foul in the third quarter. It's not that big a deal. And Van Gundy can't help it. He wears his heart on his sleeve. He dies on every play. And it's like that's you love seeing that passion, but then some people are like, dude, you gotta stop. You're killing us here. It's just too much to handle.
Frank Vogel.
Yeah, and
Yeah.
certainly, I mean,
I
you know,
got I
it's
have 11 on my list. I have Pop, Carlisle, Spo, Bud, Dwayne Casey, Steve Kerr, and this is obviously no order. Brad Stevens, Terry Stotts, Stan Van Gundy, Frank Vogel, and Doc Rivers. That's 11. I think that to answer Jeff your question, top 5, top 10, top half, I think certainly top 10, and I'd put them in my top 5.
right. And we know Derek Fisher and Byron Scott are at the bottom.
Yeah, and Jason Kidd is just really close. He's right there at 12.
Okay.
All right, last question. From Zach Jacobson, ZachJ_98. Thanks for reaching out, Zach, and thanks for listening. Can Dwayne Wade keep playing this way that he's been playing, or at least close to it, for the rest of the season? I have no reason to say he can't. He's been doing it so far.
No, I agree. He seems to be lighter. He seems to be quicker. He played well yesterday on a back to back. I mean, I think you know, hopefully we're not, knock on wood, you know, hopefully it is not something that we see later on the season where the minutes catch up to him, but he looks great. He says he's playing, you know, at full strength. He says he's healthy. Maybe the extended summer break, you know, after not making the playoffs last year really did make a big difference. And certainly, like I said, he's lost some weight and he seems to be playing well. Now, I read that he dumped his longtime trainer,
Yes.
Tim Grover.
Yes.
So that's a little disconcerting, but maybe, you know,
No,
maybe it works.
he fired him in the summer, last summer. This is one of the
Right?
reasons that he's crediting for being healthy, is that he got a new trainer, new system.
Yeah, it was something different, not for prolonging his career, you know, I guess.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's working, and that's all that matters. So
And I
to
like his
answer his
comment
question,
about his comment today was that came out today that it's like every time I do something, it's vintage. And you and I have talked about it a million times to the point of nausea that why do we keep saying that Wade is vintage? And I don't mind when we say Wade is vintage if he like takes the ball from like, you know, the top of the key and just like brings out that speed that we haven't seen in years to get to the rim. That's vintage. But when he's like in the post going to his quote unquote bag of tricks, and then some announcer goes, "Oh, that's vintage Wade right there." And that's like, I'm just like, no, that he didn't used to do that. Now he does that. That's his old man game that you and I have talked about a million times. Like, so when Wade had that comment today, it's like every time I do something, it's vintage, but I've been doing it every night. And I'm like, well, yeah, you're right. This isn't vintage. This is now Dwayne Wade. He's got a bag of tricks. He's not just going to blow by people and just Russell Westbrook people to the rim.
That's right.
So, all right, let's look ahead to the next couple of games. Friday at Milwaukee, so a few days off. Recording this on a Wednesday. They play Friday at Milwaukee, Sunday versus Atlanta. Tuesday at Houston, Wednesday at Dallas, Friday at Charlotte. So we can get that whole week out of the way. We'll probably do a podcast before then. But let's at least just get through Houston. Friday, Milwaukee, Atlanta, and Houston. Atlanta's the lone home game on a Sunday. I think I threw out a stat at some point that the Heat were actually pretty good on Sunday games. I think that's not been the case lately. I think they lost against Oklahoma City.
Yeah, that's right.
But other than that, they've been pretty good. Yeah. Other than that, I think that's been the one game that they lost, the one Sunday game they've lost. So I like Sunday games for the Heat.
I like our chances against Milwaukee, too. I know the problem was the length of that team impacting...
Well, Sunday was Atlanta. Milwaukee's Friday.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay, so we're on the same page.
Yeah. I think Wade is going to find a way. I think the two days off is going to be a big help for Spoelstra. Kind of get a chance to really coach this team up and break them down and film and stuff like that. The way Milwaukee killed us last night, I want to say that this Heat team, if I have a good pulse on them, they have enough pride where they'll probably respond with a very strong showing. And I think Milwaukee can be victimized. They're inconsistent, and I think although Miami is inconsistent, I think there's a little bit more pride there after they got, you know, demolished by them last time around. So I would say, and I talked about this earlier, but I would say that they're going to probably be much more active, cutting, doing things a little differently, and then making sure that Wade maximizes his playmaking ability, which was totally nullified the last time around.
I agree, and I think we hit a good Milwaukee team on a good stride last time, banking on the idea that this team's inconsistent, two good showings against the same team, Miami being prideful. Coming off of two wins where they're feeling good about themselves, two road wins, and I like where their head is at, especially with the rest. Sunday against Atlanta.
Like Sorry said, to go back for a second. How good is Chris Middleton, though, right?
He is fantastic.
I mean, I don't know if it's just the Milwaukee thing. And, I mean, I know he started off a little bit shaky this year, but, man, is he good.
He's right. I mean, he's right there with, like, the Jimmy Butlers of the world, but he just needs to be on a winning team. Once he's on a winning team, a high profile team with some talent on it and gets, you know, going on a playoff run or something like that on national TV, I think people are going to take more notice of him.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of Michael Redd back in the day. Remember?
That's a good one. I like that comparison. Michael Redd is not far out of the league, right? That's only about, like, he was on his last legs for a long time, but that was only about four or five years ago. Was he on like the Mavericks or something?
I want to say Phoenix?
Yeah, he was on some weird team. Like, yeah, he was just kind of like doing his thing, getting them checks, as they say.
Well, I mean, yeah, he had a long-term contract, and then the knees were just, like, he had so many knee surgeries that he was just a shell of himself. He couldn't rise up for his three-point shot, which was, you know, that was his bread and butter. So, but yeah, he was, you know, he was in Milwaukee, and nobody knew who the hell he was, and he was a, you know, one of those perennial all-star types or near all-star level. But, yeah, very underrated.
Yeah, I like the Milwaukee team a lot. As you know, I think the head coach is amazing. But
God.
You know who I'm starting to like more if they were to use him different is Michael Carter-Williams. I think he's got a little bit of a Sean Livingston as currently constructed in him.
That was the goal. That was why they traded for him.
Right. But I think you need to bring him off the bench and just have him go up against some bench guys and start posting people up and maybe not run the offense so much. Get the ball to him in the post a little bit. That would be really cool. I don't watch a lot of Bucks games, but I'm assuming that they're not doing that. Atlanta on Sunday. Like I said, only one loss this season, I believe, on Sundays. But it is Atlanta. Atlanta's playing well. Not feeling great about that game, but it is a Heat home game. It's on a Sunday. It's at 6 p.m. And I don't know. If they beat Milwaukee, they'll be riding high on a 3-game winning streak.
That's a blowout.
You think the Atlanta blows them out?
Yeah, I just think Atlanta will be kind of revitalizing. I think we talked about this last time. You know, when they come back from a road trip, that first game home is the worst.
Yeah.
And they're going to be struggling with it. So there's just going to be so much to catch up on, and they're going to be a little bit – I don't know. I don't expect a positive effort, especially against a divisional rival like Atlanta. We'll see, because I think Atlanta has been linked to a number of different trade rumors looking to move Jeff Teague or Dennis Schroeder. So there's a lot of different things that could upset their chemistry there. And, you know, it's possible. You know, and you know, if we have Whiteside back and we have Goran Dragic back and he's at full health, this could be a revitalized team. So hopefully, you know, hopefully we'll get a much more consistent effort out of this team in the next few weeks before the All-Star break.
All right, Tuesday at Houston. NBA TV. I don't know what to make of this Houston team, but...
Does anyone?
Right, exactly. So, who knows, but...
Yeah, I'm not going to bother making a prediction with that.
Yeah, me neither. But if Whiteside's playing, I'm actually excited to watch Whiteside and Dwight Howard go at it. That would be...
Yeah, I mean, it hasn't happened much, right? Has it one or the other always been out or something like that?
Yeah, and I'm hoping that's not the case in this time, because it would be cool to see that. And then Trevor Ariza has always been one of my favorite players to watch. I like watching him, and I like a lot of the Houston players. They have Josh Smith now again.
He's back.
He's going to be the Heat killer in that game. How about that for prediction? We should just start predicting Heat killers.
What is a random Heat killer?
Yep. And random scrub Heat killer.
That's it?
I think Josh Smith is just that. I think there's a universe where Josh Smith can be Boris Diaw.
Ooh.
There's like an alternate universe. It won't happen in this one, but there is an alternate universe where Josh Smith decides that he wants to be Boris Diaw. He's got even the passing ability. He could score technically from anywhere on the floor.
He's more athletic even, huh?
He's athletic. He's kind of... Yeah, he's more athletic. He kind of moves slow in that way that Boris Diaw does, but he makes it look easy. He's got the skills. He's got decent footwork. Especially in the post, it's convincing him to do it. But... Mm. If he becomes a super unselfish player and just scores when it's wide open like Boris Diaw does, there's a universe where Josh Smith is that kind of player. I mean, he's been playing at center, too. It's really interesting. All right, that about does it. Anything else you want to add, Dave?
No, I'm just glad that Pat Riley did not pull the trigger on any Chris Bosh or Blake Griffin trade, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, me too. I'm glad that that's not happening. We don't need Chris Bosh won't punch our athletic trainer in the face twice.
No.
I like Lance Stevenson's quote saying he immediately assumed most people were gonna ask him if it was him.
Yeah.
Blake Griffin punched it. That's great.
Yeah, that's a little self awareness, right? I mean, that was impressive, yeah.
Yeah.
That he knows exactly what people think of him, and it's not very much.
All right. Thanks for joining me, Dave, and thanks everybody for listening. Thanks, guys, for reaching out with the Twitter questions. That was great. We'll try to do that more often with the Twitter mailbag. This is the Heat Check Podcast. You can find us on iTunes and SoundCloud, part of the Hardwood Paroxysm Network, where you can find this podcast and a myriad other podcasts as well, all having to do with the NBA over at Hardwood Paroxysm, now on Blog Talk Radio. Thanks for listening. Thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you next time. Down to our knees, hands to the ground, feet over knees. Yeah.
finish this. Witnesses will convey just what I mean. Been feeling this way since I was 16. Came to my senses. You never liked this anyway. Fuck your friendship. I meant it. I'm African American. I'm African. I'm black as the moon. Heritage of a small village.
Ace is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.